We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. We also take email on the show. We've taken this topic from the Afternoon Magazine and moved it to Focus, and we'll talk about computers on Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Nick Baraglio and Jim Irick of CITES are with us this morning. CITES is the acronym for Campus Information Technologies and Education Services at the University of Illinois. Nick Baraglio is a network engineer. Jim Irick is a wireless network designer. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Jim, Nick, good to see you. Thanks for coming in today.
Good to see you.
All right. We've got a listener already lined up and ready to talk with us this morning. A listener on line one, St. Joe.
Good morning.
Hello.
Can you give me an idea of the life expectancy of a PC, printer, and scanner?
Some of that's probably going to depend on the environment that it's in. I've had them last upwards of 5-6 years. And they actually still worked at that point, but I wanted to upgrade them.
My PC is about that way. I've had to replace the power supply a couple of times, but otherwise it still runs. Now it's just getting slow enough where I don't want it anymore.
Yeah.
Regarding printers, it's going to depend on what kind of technology. In general, a home inkjet printer, I don't think they last too very often or very long. Whereas if you buy a medium-sized laser printer, I've seen those last upwards of 15 years.
Okay, that's good though. Well, I have a 12-year-old PC and peripherals, and there's no problems. And I'm thinking, well, I called last month, and someone said, well, that's getting kind of old equipment, and you can have problems. So what kind of problems can I possibly expect as this 12-year-old PC and peripherals, and actually software?
Well, the concern would be is whether or not you use it connected to the Internet. As an older machine, you're not going to have a modern operating system on it. You're I'm assuming you're running Windows. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep, that's right. Windows 98.
And there's the issue, is that Microsoft has not issued any is not researching and not issuing any patches for any bugs or security problems that are found in Windows 98. In fact, I don't believe they're even doing it for Windows 2000 now, and certainly not – and not Millennium. My concern is not that the computer is just going to spontaneously explode one day. It's more of a problem that if you choose to use it on the Internet, is that you're going to be open to being exploited by bugs and other things on the net.
And you may also run into issues if you want to run newer software packages that just aren't going to support an older operating system as well.
Actually, I'm having that problem right now with some things. Yeah, well, I really don't access the internet that much, but occasionally I do. So I've tried to be very disciplined when I do stuff, and I have backed up with a ton of floppy disk, and I'm thinking, well, now if I get a new desktop, is it gonna accommodate floppy disk?
Probably not, unless you go to a really special effort to find it. I believe that Sony was the last corporation that created 3.5-inch floppy disks.
Uh-huh.
They stopped doing that in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, really?
Flash is really where you should be moving towards. Floppy disks are a media that oxidizes, and it'll just go bad sitting on a shelf. You get read errors eventually, you will always have a floppy disk will always fail you eventually.
Yes.
So flash drives, little thumb drives, are definitely the way you want to go for that.
They're also substantially larger in capacity as well, so you can hold a lot more data. If your machine's running Windows 98, I believe Windows 98 was the first Windows that had a universal serial bus stack.
Yes, it does.
So if you've got a USB port on it,
right,
you should be able to buy an inexpensive flash drive and back up likely all of the things you have on your floppy disk onto one little thumb drive.
And then migrate to a newer machine.
Right.
You might find an issue with newer flash drives may be larger than what the file allocation table.
Good point.
That Windows 98 can use. So there may be some problems there. Windows 2000 was the first one that really had easy-to-use flash drive stuff. It was basically you plug it in. It said, oh, look, you plugged in a flash drive. Okay, I'm going to use it now. Windows 98, I've had to go to the manufacturer and download drivers, which now that we're many years past Windows 98, a lot of manufacturers probably are not providing that driver anymore. So it still may be an issue. But there are ways. If you can get all the data onto the hard drive in the computer, you could actually remove the hard drive from the machine and put it in a USB external enclosure and plug it into the new computer.
Hmm. Now, when you say hard drive, like putting in my area called My Documents, is that what you mean?
No, the actual entire disk, spinning disk that's inside of the computer, it has the operating system, all your installed programs, and your data. Now, you're not going to just be able to copy the installed programs over to the new computer, but all of your data that exists in that machine is on the hard drive that's in it.
Okay. So once I get it in the hard drive, then how do I transfer that to the new computer?
If it's a IDE hard drive, you can buy inexpensive, less than $30, enclosures or adapters that let you plug in that hard drive into a USB adapter. You power it on, and you plug that USB adapter into your new computer. The new computer will recognize it as a drive, and you'll be able to copy the data, just drag and drop.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
This is Focus from Illinois Public Media, and we're talking today about computers. Two guests are with us from the University of Illinois, Jim Irick. He is a wireless network designer. Nick Baraglio, also with us this morning. He's a network engineer. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions or comments. Join us by phone or by email, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. No one waiting at the moment, so maybe we could talk a little bit about, Nick, something you suggested, mobile phones. You've been doing some testing?
Jim and I have both been investigating different mobile computing platforms. The one in particular that we've been looking a lot at is the Google Android platform. There are several devices that are, you know, available on different carriers. The one that's really advertised a lot is the Motorola Droid that's available. And then there's also a device that's provided by Google. You buy it directly from them, unsubsidized. And we've been playing around quite a bit with that mobile operating system.
And what do these systems allow you to do?
It's another smartphone. Mm-hmm. Basically, it does. I mean, you have the Windows Mobile smart operating system. You have the iPhone. So it's another class in that range. And Google is the backer of the Android system. It's meant to be more open, allowing more people to write applications for it without going through somebody's approval process. A lot of people are critical of the way Apple allows applications to get added to their App Store. People get denied. And so Android is one where basically I've not heard of people getting – I'm not even sure if you can get denied as long as the program doesn't try to do something malicious to your phone.
One of the things that is different about the Android platform is that it's actually it's Linux-based, so it's open-sourced. So anyone can take it and they have the source code to it. They can compile it and put it on their own hardware. So any phone manufacturer can take this platform and adapt it to their particular devices, which makes it really attractive to a lot of the device manufacturers because then they don't have to create their own operating system in-house. And like Jim said, it's an open platform. It's very scalable. You can add a lot of features to it. You can change a lot of the way that it works. And the big selling point is that it integrates with all of Google's applications seamlessly, which a lot of people are using that. You know, a lot of people have Gmail accounts and they use the calendaring and the contacts. It all automatically syncs with your phone over the air, which makes it really nice for if you, say, lose your device, you just get the new one, you sign in with your Google account, and all of your information just comes down to it automatically.
Interesting.
It also integrates with Google Voice, which is what made Android really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. Google Voice is Google's answer to a centralized network-enabled voicemail, phone number, text location, and you can go sign up. It's free, and then you can actually tell people your Google Voice number, and then you can, when they call it, you can tell it which phones to call and what time of day that it can call that phone. It's really nice. It's finally where we're getting to the point where you just hand out this number, and no matter where you're at, no matter if you change carriers, that can always be your number, and it integrates very well with the Google, with the Android phones.
Yes.
Let's take a call from a listener. This listener is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. Somebody called and asked about how things last, I guess you'd say. And I was looking at some external hard drive. I noticed the warranties on them varies from 2, 3, and 5 years. Does that really mean a lot? Are the 5-year ones going to last a lot longer than the 2-year ones, or, you know? And what are the chances that the hard drives are going to fail?
Hard drives have moving parts in them, obviously, so they're going to be more likely to have failures than, say, something that's solid state. The way I like to think about it is not that it's going to last longer, but that it's going to fail at some point, and if it fails within a 5-year period, I can get it replaced. As opposed to if I get something with a 3-year warranty and it fails after 4 years, then I have to go purchase something else. I like to buy the ones personally that have the 5-year warranties on them for that reason alone.
Yeah,
okay,
I don't.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Jim. You were going to add something.
Well, yeah, I don't know that it actually says that it's a more reliable hard drive at all.
No.
It's just the longer warranty, and you do pay a little more money to go from the 3 or the 5. Just the big thing is to think that all hard drives are going to fail you eventually, so you should always back up somewhere else.
Okay. If someone needs to take a computer in for repair or send it off for repair, should he or she be concerned about information on that machine?
I personally would be. I tend to be a little more paranoid than most. I've been a security engineer in the past, so one of the things that I've taken, one of the attributes that I've adopted is that I tend to be very paranoid about my personal information.
Sure.
So there are several alternatives. I always keep very good backups of everything. So if I have to send something off, I'm just going to erase it before I send it off, knowing that I can restore my backup when it comes back. Some people will go as far as taking hard drives out. If the hard drive's not the problem,
mm-hmm.
they'll just remove it when they send it for repair, or they take it to the repair shop.
Yeah, I feel the same way, basically. And that goes along with not only sending in repair, I think that moves on to disposal.
Mm.
So I tell people that if they're going to, and don't throw it in the trash, you should take your computer and your old electronics things to an authorized e-waste recycler or mm-hmm. dealer, is to remove the hard drive from the machine. Give them the machine. That's the bulky part, the monitor, the keyboard, and the mm-hmm. giant box that has all the stuff in it. But take the hard drive out and then either just put it on a shelf in a closet forever or destroy it somehow. Take a hammer to it and beat the heck out of it in the backyard or something else. But don't leave the hard drive on the machine. There are way too many stories on the news about people buying old machines from these e-recyclers off of eBay, or machines showing up in China and somebody pulls the hard drive out, sticks it out, and look, oh, here's somebody's financial information.
Yep. My college roommate actually found his neighbor threw away a computer, and he's being the tech guy that he is. He asked him if he could have it. You know, it was sitting out on the pedestal. He said, sure. He took it in his house and turned it on, and the guy was a lawyer and had not erased his hard drive.
Oh,
all
my.
His legal stuff was on the machine still. And so he, you know, told him, tried to educate him about that, and went ahead and erased it for him.
Okay, very good. This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. In this hour for David Inge, we're talking this morning about computers. We've taken this topic from the Afternoon Magazine and moved it to Focus, and we'll talk about computers on Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Nick Baraglio, a network engineer, and Jim Irick, a wireless network designer, are with us this morning. They're from CITES, the Campus Information Technologies and Education Services Division of the University of Illinois. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thinking of security and privacy, Facebook, it seems, is moving toward sharing users' information with outside websites. Is Facebook morphing into something different than what it started out as?
It's certainly different than what it started out as. When it initially spun up, I believe you had to be a student to get access to it. If I could be mistaken.
You had to have an EDU address.
You had to have a .edu email address. I haven't read the new their new privacy policy, but I've read some a lot of chatter about it, and a lot of people in the security fields are very they're very scared of the direction that it's heading in. I don't know, so much that I've actually considered just closing out my Facebook account.
I did last week. I went to the Electronic Frontier Foundation and followed their instructions for opt-out of Facebook's their new instant personalization feature. And that's instructions. It's on EFF.org, and they have instructions on how to actually go out and shut down a lot of that stuff that Facebook added.
Okay. And EFF is the acronym for what, Jim?
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Okay, very good. Let's take some more calls. Next, we're going to go to Urbana. We're going to go to line two. Watsika, line two. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'm receiving from a group that I'm part of emails, and the documents come with a .dox, and I'm not able to view those or print them. Can you tell me what that extension is or what program I need to open that?
Are you sure it's not .docx?
I thought it was DOX, but it may be DOC.
I'm not familiar with DOX. I think Nick's going to do a quick search. DOCX, I believe, is the new output from the newest versions of Microsoft Word.
Okay.
And they do have, so you either need to have the newest version of Word, or Microsoft does have some plugins. It depends how, I know at least works for Office 2003. I'm not sure if it goes to any older ones, either the Office XP or the Office 2000. But they have a plugin you can install that your Office 2003 version will be able to open those files.
Yes, we have an older version of Office.
How old?
I think it's 2003.
I believe that 2003 has a plugin. If you want to search for Microsoft 2003 to Office 2007 plugin, I believe that you'll be able to find that and install it, and should be able to open those files. If not, you might investigate OpenOffice. That's a free.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Copies on my machine and on this one too.
The newest installs, updated ones.
Yes, I believe so. 3.1. Is it 3.11?
That I don't know without looking.
I think so. Anyways, I get updates regularly on that.
And have you tried to save that email attachment to your hard drive? And then 3.2 is actually according to the OpenOffice website.
Okay.
Have you tried to save that attachment to your computer? And then instead of double-clicking on it, just going into OpenOffice and doing File Open and pointing it to that file and seeing if it'll open it?
All right. I can do that. Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign, line three. And before we get to our listener on line three, Jim, Nick, you were looking something up, and apparently you've hit pay dirt.
Yeah, there is what Jim was talking about is called the Microsoft Office Compatibility Pack, and it's downloadable from Microsoft's website.
Okay.
And that allows for the compatibility with the newer formats.
Okay, now let's go to our listener in Champaign on line three. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have two real quick questions and one more philosophical one. The first is that I have a PC running XP that's quite old, and I'm noticing that over time the USB drives are beginning not to work. And obviously when none of them work, we're in trouble because then our mouse won't work. I'm wondering if there's something simple I can look at, or do I need to take that in?
So we're talking about the USB ports on the actual motherboard? Because your mouse is plugged into it, is that right?
Yeah, and so we've been able to, for a short period of time, the mouse will work, and then after about sometimes 10 to 15 minutes, sometimes an hour, all of the USB ports will go out. So I can't diagnose it as being part of the operating system. Again, I'm running XP and it's an old machine, or whether it's just it's life.
It sounds like a hard drive or a hardware problem. I would point it to either the power supply or the motherboard.
Okay.
Either one of them. Power supply is easy to try out. I mean, power supplies are relatively inexpensive and swap out and see what happens. If it's a motherboard, that can get really pricey in a hurry to because you're not – if it's an older machine, you're probably not going to be able to find a motherboard just like that one. So when you replace the motherboard in the machine, now Windows has to be completely made aware of all the new drivers and resources that are on the new motherboard. And when it gets to that point, unless you're actually a computer tech that's going to do the work yourself, you may investigate just replacing the machine.
Yeah, that's – thank you. It's actually a fused motherboard anyway, so sounds a good idea. Second question. External hard drive that has been formatted for PCs and has data on it that I would like to add files from a Mac. And I'm wondering if I can partition the hard drive without losing the data that's already on it.
So actually,
format a portion of it?
No. Well, I would look at what file system is that format using, because modern – and I don't know how old this goes back. Nick can talk about this. Is modern OS X can open and completely work with the FAT32 partition system, which was introduced as part of Windows 98, I think.
Yeah.
But on a newer machine, like if you format it on an XP machine or newer, the operating system may have chosen to format the hard drive as NTFS, which Macs don't really like.
That's what's happened.
There are mechanisms for making that work. The success rate is spotty. I believe I can
buy a second external hard drive and format that one.
Well, what about – is there a way that you can temporarily copy that data to somewhere else and then reformat the drive to FAT32 and then copy the data back?
Yeah, that's a possibility. Good idea.
That's what I would try first.
Thank you. And my last question is a philosophical one. As I think a growing number of families find that they have multiple operating systems and platforms and phone contracts and all of that. I'm wondering if you can speak about how a family can work with compatibility issues between what we find at our household is that if our kids are using Macs and we're using PCs, sometimes we run into these sorts of glitches, and the external hard drive is a good example.
Generally speaking, the Macintoshes can usually handle most of the things that the PC is going to create, with the exception of maybe the NTFS file system, which I just looked up, and it does actually – you can read and write that. It's an experimental driver. If you do a search for OS X NTFS, you'll find lots of information on it. The other way around generally has been the hang-up in the past, the Mac to PC. The way that I've gotten around that is I do everything over the network. So Macs can do file sharing with Windows machines pretty easily, and vice versa. So if you set up file sharing, you can usually move the documents back and forth, and as long as the documents are in standard format, like a Word document or a plain text file or what have you, it should work fine.
And that's one of the ones where you could standardize if we're talking about like Office packages.
Right.
If you standardize – I mean, you could install Office, Microsoft Office. I believe it's 2007 for the Windows machines and 2008 for the OS X machines. Or you could standardize on something like OpenOffice, like we said, in the newest version 3.2, and that's a cross-platform package.
Yep.
So then you that would save in a document format that will work on all the machines.
Another thing that I've done is with my wife and I, because her job, she has a Windows machine, and at home we have all Macs, we've just gone to using Google Documents for everything. That way I don't even have to worry about backing up. It stays on their system, and it's a standard format. I can download it as whatever format I choose at that point.
And if you have a home network, looking at a possibility is something like a NAS, a network-attached storage, which is a hard drive basically with a network card plugged into it. That one, typically they'll use Windows protocols, typically considered Windows protocols to talk, which the Macs and all the PCs and Linux boxes can talk to. And then you can save all your files in a common space, or at least back up to that common space, and then all the computers in the house will have access to it.
Okay, hope that helps. Next, we're going to go to a listener on line one in Homer. Hi.
Hi there. Okay, my question is, I would miss part of the early conversation there because I stepped away from the radio for a little bit. And when I was coming back, I think you said something about the floppy disks do not last very long. Explain that again, please.
My experience with floppy disks is that a floppy disk will always let you down at the most inopportune time. It's been many years since I just swore off any type of spinning media for portable stuff and moved to thumb drives or USB-connected flash media.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Well, it's a media. It's exposed to the elements. I mean, yes, you have the little flip cover across it on the 3.5s. 5.25s were even worse. The disk media was just open to the air. That media oxidizes. It flakes off. Your floppy disk drive heads get dirty, and eventually things will go bad.
Yeah, well, I've saved every all the business records for years and years on that. Each year.
Yeah.
Floppy disk.
I would think that maybe if you went back to the first one you have, you may not be able to read that data anymore.
Okay. So is there a way to transfer that then easily?
Well, if the data is readable, then the best thing I would consider is to copy it to a machine that you have that can read that media to the hard drive there, and then buy a USB thumb drive and copy the data to that thumb drive.
Yeah, we got that. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Good luck to you. Next, we take a call from a listener on line 4 in Loda. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have two questions, both of which require shareware or free software in the question. First one is there a good shareware or free package for incremental backups on a network?
Windows comes with one built in, but as far as there's not a lot that I've used that are good network incremental backup stuff that's free. I'll let Nick.
The Macintosh can do it. It doesn't do it by default. You can create what's called a sparse image on a network drive and back up to that from your Mac using the built-in Time Machine application. It requires a couple of extra steps, but if you do searches for it, there are lots of how-tos online on how to set that up because a lot of people are using it.
Okay. But Windows would be the Windows program itself should work. Is that right?
Windows does have a backup program built in depending on how old the operating system is, how well it is to work with. In my opinion, I've usually moved to other products. The Windows one was either just didn't do exactly what I wanted to, or it was just too hard for a customer to configure it. So I've looked at some other, and they're not freeware. It's commercialware. And this came out, the OS X has the new product called Time Machine, which is not network. That's only to locally, unless you have the
unless you create the sparse bundle.
You have the time capsule.
Or you have a time capsule.
You have a time capsule. Otherwise, it's to a locally plugged in hard drive. Mm-hmm. But there's a copycat of that, basically, for Windows machines that's called Genie Timeline, and it's by a company called GenieSoft. And it will back up to either locally connected or network drives, and it's very – like I said, it's very similar to the way the Time Machine works on the OS X, where you basically just tell it where the files are that you want protected, and it goes through, and when you make changes to the files, it automatically makes backups.
I see.
And it's not just incremental because you can – it'll go – well, it is incremental, but it'll allow you to go back in time also. So it has a much easier graphical user interface to work with than – your standard Windows backup or any tool that I think that would be more pointed towards a network administrator as an incremental backup.
Okay. look into that. Second question has to do with a way to manage all the passwords that I have. Is there a program that would help me do that, simplify that, give me references or something like that?
Good question.
Indeed, and I use one every day. It's a free package. I believe it's multi-platform, and it's called KeePass, and it's KeePass. I'm going to if I get in the right search box here, we'll see where we get it from. Yeah, it's called KeePass Password Safe, and I use that. All my passwords are stored in that.
And obviously you consider that safe then.
Well, and I keep it on a flash drive in my pocket.
Oh.
So I do have to type in you do have to type a password in to get to it, so the data is encrypted. So I don't, and like I said, I don't even leave it as a copy of it on my home computer. It's actually on a flash drive. So I kind of have two levels of protection there. It's not normally plugged in, and when it is plugged in, I have to type a password in to open the file.
Very good. Very good. Is that a shareware program?
It's freeware.
Freeware. Great. Been very helpful. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call this morning. And we're going to take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one is next. Hello.
Good morning. The cable modem that our cable system provides has a wireless feature that we use. It makes it convenient for the other laptops in the house. You know, don't have to run cable. The security feature on it is not activated. Short of like the neighbor using our system or whatever, can anybody actually do any harm, or is it be safe enough to leave it as it is, or should be installed a security password and all that?
You should absolutely lock down your wireless for the simple reason that someone else can easily join that network and sniff any traffic that's passing on that network with minimal effort. So any data that passes in the clear over that is fair game for anybody to look at.
Okay. And would activating that feature would be difficult to do?
Usually the security features are made pretty straightforward in the newer home gateways. It's usually a couple of check boxes that you need to click and then typing in a password.
I see. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
This is Focus. We're talking this morning about computers. Two guests are with us this morning, Nick Baraglio and Jim Irick. They are with Campus Information Technologies and Education Services at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about computers by phone or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222. Will, our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we had a caller a little bit earlier who talked, I think it might have been the first caller we had this morning, who asked about the life of a printer. And I think, Nick, you said it depended somewhat on the environment. And somebody called in and wanted to know, what does that mean? Are you talking about climate, or what are you talking about?
Absolutely. What I'm talking about specifically is what reminds me of that is a incident that I ran into when I was in college and I was doing consulting for a company, and I had to go to this. It was in the middle of the country. It was a big farm, a commercial farm, and they had a building, an outbuilding that. They had run cabling to it, and they had printers and computers and things in there. And the temperature, it was not temperature controlled. It wasn't clean. You know, it's a farm
dusty,
building,
right?
It was very dusty, and the lifetime of electronics can be significantly shortened by quote suboptimal climate conditions or operating conditions. So, if you've got it in an environment that gets very hot, it's very humid, or it's very dirty, you can substantially shorten the life of your equipment.
Okay.
A lot of what happens in the dirty things like in dirty environments is that you're actually causing problems with the cooling of the computer, and heat is an enemy of electronic chips. You get dust and it clogs up the cooling intakes. It gets all over the cooling fins that are inside the device and doesn't allow them to work efficiently. Not only dusty and stuff, and I've worked on farm computers too, is smoking. If you sit your ashtray at home in front of your computer and it sucks that in, the tar covers the fans and the fan bearings. And the smaller fans that are on the that keep parts of the motherboard cool will fail.
Yes.
I've seen it over and over again.
Yeah, it wasn't too long ago I reached down here to take a look at the tower we've got in the studio, and I thought, oh my gosh, nobody's dusted this forever. You know, it looks like it felt like a cat had been sleeping on it. You know, because we have the fuzz from the carpet and whatnot. And I thought, good grief, I got to remember to do that once in a while, because it's here in the studio and you take it for granted and it's out of sight. And
I do recommend that no PCs actually sit directly on the floor, either up on a desk or perhaps at least elevated at least like 6 to 12 inches off the floor, just because of the dust and fuzz on the floor, running the vacuum cleaner next to it and things like that.
Yeah. And chances are, however dusty it is on the outside, it's 3 to 4 times more dusty on the inside.
Okay.
Because the fan is sucking air in.
Yeah.
Trying to circulate
it. Okay, so we're going to have to keep an eye on this. It's about 4 inches off the ground, actually. So. Well, let's take another call. Let's go next to Champagne Line 1. Hi. Line one?
Hello?
Muhammad? Line one?
Muhammad, yes. I was working with a new Windows 7. I just got Windows 7. And I have a lot of good stuff in my Windows Media Center. And I want to get it off my computer so I don't slow my computer down. And I have all these half-hour programs that I haven't had time to watch yet, and I would like to put them on a DVD. But I hate using a DVD that has 120 minutes on each one. You know, is there a way to put those two of those in a folder and then put that folder on the DVD?
There should be able to just burn multiple files to the same DVD. But before that, I want to address the topic about the slowing the machine down by having lots of media on it. In general, just having data on your hard drive is not going to cause a significant performance problem for your machine. Now, if you fill up the entire hard drive where there's not even enough hard drive space for the operating system to do what it needs to just go about its daily activities and open up and run programs for you, that's a different story. But as long as there is, I don't know, at least a gig or two free on the hard drive, I would not consider that that's a performance degradation.
Well, thank you. I guess I had the wrong impression. I don't know the different kinds of memory involved, but that's interesting. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call. Next, we're going to take a call from a listener on line 4. Where are you calling from this morning? Line 4? Okay. That's you.
Oh, line 4. Yes, from Bloomington, Illinois.
Okay, go ahead.
We listen to quite a bit of music on the PC, and I like using the Windows Explorer to find the music, click, and you know, play with Windows Media Player. And that works out fine. However, we also have an Apple, I think it's called a Air Base Station, and we have that plugged in the garage hooked up to the stereo. Now, my issue is, however, if I want to play music from the PC in the house and listen to it in the garage, I need to play using iTunes. Which I can do that, but I really don't like iTunes that well. Is there a way to find my music through Windows Explorer and then play but and click on it so it plays using iTunes?
That I really can't answer. I don't have the Airbase that accessory from Apple that lets you do that. I used to be the same way with music on my machine. I have since switched to iTunes, and I'm very happy I did. I don't know if you've had iTunes obviously scan all your stuff. I mean, all your media in, so you have all your music loaded.
Right.
I don't know. Right. Once my music collection exceeded several thousand files, I was much happier letting iTunes sort it for me. And then the feature that really convinced me to switch to iTunes was the Genius option, where I can select a single song that I like, and then iTunes picks other songs out of my collection that it thinks I will like based on that selection.
Hmm.
Once I started using that, I never regretted switching all my music over to iTunes.
Oh,
I'm sorry we can't – I can't answer your original. Nick's going to have an idea maybe about that, but perhaps we can just get you to use iTunes.
I was able to go out and play around with the Reg Edit, and when I did that, I was able to find a line in there where when I right-click on the file, I do get iTunes as an option.
That's exactly what I was going to suggest.
but then the thing is, it doesn't take my selections, though, and – as if, you know, drop them into iPlayer or into the iTunes. So it just says you can go and right-click on a Windows Explorer icon and you can say, play with Windows Media Player. I can't do that to say, play with iTunes. I can just only get iTunes to come up as an option. So I can click that, and then, indeed, iTunes will launch, but my selections aren't there to play.
That was the suggestion I was going to have. Or that I was going to make.
Not put in everything I need to put in, of course, in the registry. That could be.
Well, the registry would be, I don't know, Jim, could you enlighten a little bit? You know more about the Windows registry than I do.
Well, I mean, there's lots of good and bad things you can certainly do with the Windows registry. In this case, I don't know. I would really have to say that you're going to have to go to Google and see your favorite search engine and search around and find if somebody else has done something like this. Because, one, I've never actually worked with one of those – with that Apple device. And so I've never had a chance to even try to make this work.
I've only used that Apple device with iTunes, so I'm
– okay. I'll work a little more with iTunes. And then just one more question kind of along the same lines then. Just as I use the Apple Airbase station, is there a product that would do the same thing with Windows so that I could just – remotely plug into it, an outlet out in the garage, plug the stereo in.
I believe there's like a, I think it's called Roku.
I've been looking for a Roku.
Roku or a Slingbox.
Yeah, there's several devices out there that will open up using the Windows file sharing protocols. Mm-hmm. Will open up wherever you point it to, like so your PC that has the music on it, and then import that. It knows what songs are out there, and then it'll let you select them and song
right.
And pick the song. It's not like you're actually streaming the music like you are with the Apple device, but you're actually just opening up the raw music file from your PC, and it's being decoded and played out of the like the Roku device.
Right.
Right. Okay. All right, you've been very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener waiting for us on line one. Where are you calling from?
From Champaign.
Okay.
I heard you talking about the cleaning. I don't know if you talked about the best way to clean the computer. I heard you talking about how dirty they get. So what is the best way to clean it? Somebody told me you should not use a vacuum cleaner.
So I have conflicting I was originally taught years and years ago to use compressed air to blow out the machines, and you can go buy little cans of compressed air. And then at another job that I had after that, I had a gentleman tell me that no, that's not the right way to do it. All you're doing is moving the dirt around. At that point, you need to use a vacuum. So I've done both, and to me they were basically the same. With the vacuum, the caveat is you have to make sure that you don't vacuum in something that isn't connected very well, like little screws that aren't in all the way, or
Somebody said it was the static electricity you had to worry about.
I never had any problem with it. I always would wear a static strap on myself, but generally I used compressed air because that's what I only had the one gentleman tell me to use the vacuum. Everywhere else I ever did any of that kind of work was always compressed air.
Right.
So the best thing is to open up, kind of blow all that stuff out of there if you can.
Take it outside.
Yeah, take it outside.
Once in a while, do that.
Yeah, I mean, and using the vacuum with a hose attachment to, like, if there's a lot of dust on the outside, on the grill of the computer, I think there's not an issue with that. And maybe even if you open it up and there's a lot of dust bunnies just sitting in the bottom
mm-hmm.
of the machine, I think a vacuum cleaner is appropriate there. But as far as blowing out the fan, I don't think a vacuum cleaner will actually remove the dust from the fan blades very well.
No.
I think that you really need to go to a compressed air system for that. I'm not very fond of those little cans of compressed air. I don't think they have enough power. I usually, and there's going to be some people cringing, have actually just gone out to the shop, dialed down the pressure out of my shop air compressor, and just put an air nozzle on it. The big thing is to make sure you're actually dialing the pressure down fairly low enough so you're not blowing parts off the motherboard. I have seen people blow out their keyboard this way and actual keys go flying. The other issue is to make sure you actually blow it out just pointing it at the floor a couple of times to make sure that if there's any condensation in the line, you're not shooting that water straight into your machine. And if you do have a if you can put a water separator on the output line of your compressor, that's even better.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this morning. Sounds like kind of a red-green operation. anyway, this is Focus, and we're talking about computers this morning. Jim Irick and Nick Baraglio are with us today. They are with CITES, Campus Information Technologies and Education Services at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Jim?
I have something, if we don't have any callers, to bring up. It's about, and I don't think we got to cover this last time, it's about a little green power strips. I don't know if we covered that or
we mentioned it just a little bit at the end, and it was very intriguing. But
right.
Yeah.
So I don't know if anybody has any other questions. I still am using my APC branded, and there's several brands. I think Smart is another brand of green power strip. I plug my PC and tell it plug it into a specific port, and then when I shut my computer off at night, the AC power adapters, which are always using power, even when you're not using your computer, if it's not even turned on, the AC, those little wall warts, as people call them, are using, converting electricity to energy and mm-hmm. going right on your bill. When I shut my PC off, that system detects that, and it shuts off the power to my monitor and my printers and the speakers and all that. So,
okay, so at the end of the day, you shut everything down.
Yes. Yeah, I actually, unless I'm using the machine, I shut off my PCs at night. I don't shut them off if I'm going back and forth using it during the day. I basically, once it's turned on for the day, it's mm-hmm. left on the whole day, and then I shut it off at night.
Now, I was told by someone that there's a security concern when you shut the computer down. In other words, there could be updates coming through.
Depending on how your machine is managed, and Jim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but some Windows policies can dictate that your updates get pushed out at night. A lot of times, there's newer PCs have really nice mechanisms for this. You can tell them, you can schedule shutdown and wake up times. You can schedule sleep times. Like on my machines at home, I have them off when I'm not using them, but if I think I might need to get something off of it from, you know, remotely, I'll have it sleep, and then I'll use a mechanism called wake on LAN. I'll get into my network remotely, and I'll wake it up remotely, and then I can pull all the information off of it and make it go to sleep. You can also set my machines at work, or I'll schedule to shut down at the end of the day, and then automatically, and then power back up in the morning before I get there. You know, a half hour or so before I get there.
So in a half hour before you get there, if there are any updates, they're
coming
in.
It pulls all that down. Yep.
And a lot of Windows machines are to the point where if they miss an update cycle, even the antivirus or the built-in security Windows updates, if they miss an update cycle, the next time you turn the machine on, they will let you know that you need to address that. The other thing to do is just change under the control panel for Windows updates, change the time. I think by default it's usually 2 or 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Just change it to when you go to lunch.
Oh.
Yeah.
And let it do all that stuff over lunch.
Yeah. Back to the issue of having a clean machine. What do you recommend for cleaning screens, and how should you properly clean a screen so you don't damage it?
For LCD screens, there's a I'm trying to remember what it's called. There's a little pack you can buy, and it has a wet and a dry, basically like a it looks like a wet nap like you would get when you go and eat ribs or something.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them's wet, and one of them's called a polishing cloth, and that's what I've always used to clean my LCD screens.
I would definitely not use household window glass cleaners.
Yeah, absolutely,
they have ammonia and things in them, and those could react negatively with the coating and the mm-hmm. anti-glare coatings and things that are on the LCD screen. One of the things I've used in a pinch is the alcohol glass cleaner that my optometrist provides with my new glasses, because they're also my glasses have coatings on them, so they don't react with those coatings. And in a pinch, I've actually used that on my monitor. The big thing is if you are spraying a liquid on your monitor, either the best thing is to actually spray it onto the cloth and then wipe the wipe the cloth on the monitor. Or if you're going to spray it on the monitor, make sure you wipe it off before it hits the bottom.
Okay. Yes.
And you also want to be careful of the cloth you're using. Would microfiber be a good choice?
Actually, I'm not sure, Jim.
Yeah, I think so. I think my last laptop, actually, the one I'm using today, Dell actually provided it, and I would call that a microfiber material. There are special stuff if you go to any big box store.
Well, I think we'll start to wrap things up here this morning. This is Focus, and today we've had the phone lines and the email open for Jim Irick and Nick Baraglio. Jim is a wireless network designer. Nick is a network engineer. They're both with Sites, the acronym for Campus Information Technologies and Education Services at the University of Illinois. And computers is a topic that we've taken from the afternoon magazine, and we've moved it here to Focus, and we'll talk about computers on Focus on the first Thursday of the month. And my thanks this morning to everyone who called in and to our guests, Nick and Jim. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Birchtree Counseling and Consulting, Champaign; Cannon Farm, Camargo; Carpet Weavers, Champaign; and Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 2 minutes before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices and how they are faring in Kansas City and in Chicago. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at 505, down 10 and a half. July, 518 and three quarters, down 5 1/4. May wheat in Chicago, $5.15. That's down 1/2. July, 507 1/2, down 4 1/2. May corn, 370, up 5 1/4. July, 377 1/4, up 4 1/4. September, 383 1/4, up 2 1/2. December, 390 1/2, up 1 1/4. May soybeans, 964 1/2, down 3 3/4. July, 973, down 5. August, 968 3/4, down 6 3/4. September, 954 3/4, down 6 3/4. November, 947 1/2, that is down 8. May soybean meal, 280 even, up 30. May oil, 38.38, down 26. June live cattle, 96.82 1/2, up 12 1/2. August, 95.02 1/2, down 22 1/2. May feeder cattle, 113.85, down 5. August, 116.62 1/2, down 5. May lean hogs, 89.50, up 15. On to the outside markets next. June crude, 78.73. down 1.24. The U.S. dollar, 84.65. That's up 57. The CRB index, 265.39. down 2.56. And as of 15 minutes ago, the Dow was off 77 points at 10,789. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Henry Frayne. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in northern and far west,